the mitzvot we'll quickly run through are the mitzvah of Ve'at Arosh, leaving a corner of the hair, as we'll discuss. Pat Zakan, not shaving with the razor blade. Honoring our parents, paying wages on time. A little bit about the laws of family purity, maybe to understand a little bit what the real laws, what it's really all about. The mitzvah of having children, the obligations between a husband and a wife. The mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen, redeeming a firstborn son. The mitzvah of honoring Shabbos, enjoying Shabbos. The mitzvah of taking off challah, taking off a little bit of dough when you prepare a large batch of dough. The mitzvah of shatnez, wool and linen, that we're not supposed to have a garment of wool and linen mixed together, and kilayim and orla. The mitzvah of meat and milk, we're not supposed to mix them or cook them together. The mitzvah of honoring the elder. The mitzvah of hachnasat ochim, having guests. Mitzvah of tzedakah, the mitzvah of redeeming someone who's in captivity, the mitzvah of chinuch, education, and then we'll discuss a little bit about tzniut and good traits. Everything we're discussing is biblical. I wanted to stick to the biblical, you know, so it's very clear. So let's begin. You have any other mitzvot you want us to cover? Okay. So firstly, when it comes to Pat HaRosh, so we know that the Torah gives us mitzvot, and the Torah doesn't explain to us the logic behind it. We can understand certain logics. We can understand some things make sense to us. It says, don't kill. We can understand that. It says, honor your parents. We can understand that. But at the end of the day, when we do mitzvot, we have to know that God said so. He created the world. He knows what's better for us. We don't always understand why. Sometimes you say, you know, if I didn't keep Shabbos, my neighbor, he made a mint over Shabbos, and my shop was closed on Shabbos. I didn't make all that money. Okay, right. We don't understand the logic. We are told that God says this is the best way for you to live life on this planet. Forget the world to come. I'll reward you in the world to come. But that's not the Torah. The Torah is about planet Earth. You want to know what's the best life? It's here. And the Torah gives us mitzvot, some of which we have a better understanding of where they come from, some we don't. And some we could surmise. In the days of the Torah, it was common practice that the pagans, the priests, used to shave around their head. They'd leave only, like the monks, I don't know if you saw ancient pictures of the monks, they'd only leave the center of the hair. So we could surmise that just like the monks took it from the pagans, the Torah said, don't do like the pagans. The Torah said, you have to maintain the corner of your hair. What does it mean, maintain the corner of your hair? So if you take the hairline coming up to the widow's peak, and then you take the hairline behind the ear, and you match them. So the Torah says, if you take the hairline from here, going down to the back of the ear, from here downward, the hair that grows from your hair, not the beard here, that hair may not be cut close to the skin. Meaning you have to leave the hair long enough that you could fold the hair onto itself. What is that, 3 millimeters? It doesn't have to be too long. No, down to here. Just don't equate the two hairlines. Meaning from here downward, this corner, you take a line, you draw a line going down from the widow's peak down to the hairline behind the ear, and you say from there, from that line downward, I can't shave. It doesn't matter if I'm using scissors or I'm using a razor blade or I'm using anything else. The hair must be left long enough that each hair can be folded onto itself. The Torah says, don't shave this close. This you're not supposed to shave off.
That seems higher than, don't they say like the cheekbone?
Oh, so we say coming down till the cheekbone. Oh, this is hair that comes from the head. From the cheekbone downward, we say this is beard hair already. So that's a different mitzvah.
This line from here to here seems higher than the cheekbone.
It's higher than the cheekbone. We go all the way down. We say from that line downward. No, that's the mitzvah. From that line downward, Hashem says, this corner of hair on your head, leave. Don't shave it off.
So not from this line upwards, from this line downwards.
Correct. From that line downwards, you're not supposed to shave off. So you could take a haircut, just don't cut this real close. And here it doesn't matter with what instrument you're cutting it. The idea is leave the hair long enough that each hair can be folded onto itself. So that's mitzvah number one, biblical mitzvah. Mitzvah number two.
Like there are people, religious people, who have seen that shave everything. Like,
well, then they don't know. Most people will leave payas, but people leave this corner. People who know about Torah and mitzvahs will usually leave payas. Sometimes when people leave payas, they don't realize and they're not leaving big enough. You know, they leave a little thing and they don't realize that this whole thing has to be left at least long enough that a hair could be folded onto itself. But if a person goes to a barber that knows what he's doing, or a person himself knows what he's doing, so he knows this whole clump of hair has to be left a little bit longer. Then we come to the corners of the beard. So we don't know exactly where the corners are. We know it's the corners of different bones on the face. It might be down here, it might be over here by the chin, it might be over here, it might be over here. There are different places where we have bones, so we're not sure. We know there are five locations on the face where it's biblically prohibited to shave with a razor. But we don't know where those five locations are. A razor blade, yeah. Yeah, with the blade.
But not an electric shaver.
Oh, we'll get the electric shaver in a second. So Torah says you're not allowed to cut the hair on the face in five places. We don't know where they are. So we apply this to the whole face because we don't know where those five biblical prohibitions are. With a blade that will destroy the hair from the root. A razor blade cuts it from the root. That's what happens. You put the cream and then cuts down and cuts beneath the skin a little bit.
Is that why?
One second. We don't know why. Again, one understanding is that this is what the pagans used to do in those days. We don't know the logic of the Torah. We know that this is a biblical mitzvah, that a Jew is not supposed to shave with a razor on his face.
Somebody once told me that the reason is because with a razor you might cut yourself and you're not allowed to cause harm to yourself.
I don't think so.
No?
So now the question is, what about shavers? So the prohibition is a slicing action. And the question is, how do shavers work? Once upon a time, this wasn't the question. Shavers worked in a very simple way. You had a screen. You had a blade that ran under the screen. And the blade, together with the screen, would have a scissor action in which it would cut like a scissor. So if you're cutting like a scissor, so it says you're not allowed to cut with a knife. You could cut with a scissor. That's not a problem. Today, we have lift and cut. And what lift and cut really does is that the screen is just protecting your skin from being cut. The shaver pulls in the hair together with the root, and then the knife slices it. Really, the knife is cutting like any other knife. It's just a blade that twirls quickly. But it's really cutting like a knife. It's not cutting with the scissor action of breaking it against the screen. No, the screen is just protecting your skin. So today we run into questions about many different shavers, which shavers are in line with halacha and which aren't. There is an opinion. There's Rav Trivitz in Harnov, who's of the opinion that shavers are all okay. Most opinions say that the lift and cut are not okay. You can take out the lift and cut mechanism. You could go online to koshershavers.org, I think it's called, and they show you how to take out the lift and cut mechanism. Or there are shavers that rabbis have checked, and those shavers are okay. You can find out which shavers are good and which aren't. There are a lot of good shavers on the market. It's more than likely that the shaver you have, if you call up and verify, if it's not good the way it is, maybe you just take out the lift and cut mechanism and then it works well. And it's a good kosher shaver. But that's the prohibition. The prohibition is you're not supposed to cut your beard with a blade. And the issue with our shavers is that some of them do function like blades. The screen is just there to protect your skin, but they're really not acting like scissors, but they're acting like a razor blade.
What about the trimmer mechanism? Are there any problems with that?
I don't know. I don't know. Logic would dictate that it's okay, right? Because it seems to be doing a scissor action, the trimmer, right? That's the way it would seem. Okay, we're going on to the next mitzvah, the mitzvah of honoring our parents. So honoring our parents is in things that pertain to them. Let's say your father says, I don't like that you wear a blue shirt, I want you to wear a brown shirt. What does it affect him when I'm here in Israel? If I'm wearing a blue or a brown shirt, it doesn't affect him. You know, parents can't just take advantage of the smits and tell their kids what to do and everything. No. The halacha even says, let's say your father says, I don't want you to marry that girl. You don't have to listen to him. Might be wise to listen to him. Just last night I was on the phone with a couple that got engaged, and his parents said, no, you're not getting married yet. You're going to wait half a year. So I told them, you know, the halacha backs you. Halachically, you don't have to listen to your parents. But intellect says, don't go fight them. You know, they're your parents. You want to have a good relationship with them. They're going to be your in-laws. So just because the halacha says you don't have to listen to them doesn't mean you should say, well, I don't have to listen. Goodbye, guys. I'm getting married. No, why? Figure out. Go slowly. Be nice. And find a compromise. They get married in 3 months. And instead, they want 6 months. You want tomorrow. It's a compromise. You know, find a peaceful way of doing it. But technically, the halachos of kibud av v'aim are about things that pertain to the parent. So if the parent needs help doing the shopping, and you go do the shopping, so that's kibud av v'aim. If a parent needs help putting his shoes on, putting his jacket on, putting his coat on, that's kibud av v'aim. We have to know that the obligation to help one's parents is at their expense. If your parents send you shopping, you don't have to do it on your credit card. You could say, Mom, Dad, I'll be happy to take time. I'll go do the shopping. Can you give me the credit card? You know, they could be on their, it should be on their expense. Now, let's say you're making $1 million a year, and they're making $10,000 a year. So then Allah expects that, being that you could afford it and you would be helping other people with your money, you should help your parents. They're no worse than anyone else. They're better than anyone else. We have an element of we owe respect to our parents. Now, in honoring our parents, so part of it is also understanding where they're coming from. People sometimes say Father's Day is not a Jewish concept. Okay, but if in your father's mind, Father's Day is an important day, so give him a call on Father's Day and make him happy. So what? Yeah, according to Judaism, every day you're supposed to honor your parents. You're supposed to call and wish them a good Shabbos. You're supposed to call and hear how they're doing. It's part of honoring our parents. We also have an obligation to honor our in-laws. We have an obligation to honor our grandparents. We have an obligation, our wives' parents. You know, even though they might not be our favorite people in the world, hopefully they are. But, you know, King David, you know who his father-in-law was? King Saul. He married King Saul's daughter. So King Saul was trying to kill him, right? King David is on the run. And at one point, you know the story in the cave? That King Saul went in to go to the bathroom, and King David cut off the corner of his coat while he wasn't looking. And then King Saul went out of the cave, and then King David came out after him and said, "Look, I could have killed you. Look, I have the corner of your coat. Just like I cut the coat, I could have cut you, but I didn't. I don't want to kill you. Why are you chasing after me?" So here's a conversation where the son-in-law is on the run, the father-in-law is trying to kill him. And when King David walks out of that cave holding the corner of King Saul's coat, you know what he says? He says, "Avi," what does Avi mean? My father. Re'e gam re'e. From there we derive that a son-in-law is supposed to call his father-in-law dad. It's part of respect. You don't. It's not a biblical obligation, but it's a nice thing to do. I hope your father-in-laws won't be trying to kill you. But in that scenario, his father-in-law is trying to kill him, and even there, look at the respect that he had. So the mitzvah of Kibud Av Aim is honoring our parents. We don't contradict them. We don't interrupt when they say things. When they're having an argument, we don't come in and say, "Well, I think it's like that." You know, we have. There's a certain element of respect. It's not easy. You know, parents, one of the halachos in Kibud Av Aim, it says parents should go easy on their kids, because even though this is a biblical obligation, it's a hard obligation on the kids. So this is the one halacha in the Codex, in the Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch says, but go easy on this one. Shulchan Aruch says, because it's hard. It's hard on the kids, but at the end of the day, it's our obligation. We have a mitzvah to pay wages on time. That means if you hire a babysitter, so the Torah says, let's say she worked at night, you guys went out at night, you come back home, you got to pay the babysitter that night. Don't tell her, "Well, the ATM machine was closed and I'll get it to you tomorrow." You have a special mitzvah, a biblical mitzvah, to pay a worker on time. A worker comes and paints your house by day, so then the mitzvah is to pay him that day. Of course, if you agree differently, you know, you could have all kinds of agreements with a worker. But if it's a regular worker, if it's a plumber that comes and works for a half hour, he's expecting to get paid that day. Biblical mitzvah, pay a guy on time. A guy who works by day should be paid that day. A guy who works by night should be paid that night. Now we come to the laws of family purity. So, let's begin by going a step back. What's the first mitzvah in the Torah?
Be fruitful and multiply.
Well,
it depends.
So we have, okay, but we have a basic mitzvah of having children. And we have a mitzvah to be kind to our fellow men. And we have a mitzvah beyond that, that a husband has certain obligations towards his wife. You know what those three obligations are? Obligations are, oh, she'er, he's giving her the food she needs, the basic needs she has. Kisut, the clothing that she needs. And ona, what is ona? Ona literally means time. But what it's referring to is intimacy. A husband has an obligation of intimacy towards his wife. So one of the things a husband is obligated to do is be intimate with his wife. Now, notice, which word does the Torah use for being intimate? Onah. What does onah mean? Time. Meaning, the biblical obligation of being intimate is not just about an act. It's about being romantic. It's about indicating to her that you adore her. The biblical mitzvah of onah is defined based upon what are a wife's needs in order to feel adored. That's a husband's obligation. So the Torah says a husband has an obligation not only to bring children to the world, the mitzvah of pruvu. He also has an obligation to give his wife the feeling that she's adored. You know, there are gemaras and there's a halacha that describes how often does a husband have to be, what's the minimum that he must be with his wife. So it says, depends on his job. What's the idea behind it? If the wife sees the husband comes home every day at 4 o'clock, and he sits home from 4 o'clock till 12 o'clock every night, reading the newspaper, drinking his beer, watching the sports game, she says, wait a second, if he really loved me, how could he not be interested in me tonight? So you tell yourself, what husband wants to be with his wife every single night? To you guys, that might sound like, well, everyone does. Yeah, but you'll see, after a person gets married, first year, 2 years, 3 years, but at some point, you run into normal family life. What husband, even the most delicious ice cream, even the thing that's the best in the world, at the end of the day, no one wants it every day.
What about a case where he has more than one wife?
Oh, wait, okay. We'll worry about that at a different time. But at any rate, the idea behind his obligation in such a case to be intimate with his wife every night is not because we're saying he'll desire it every night or she'll desire it every night. No. But the question is, what message are you giving her? Do you really think she's beautiful? Do you really adore her? If you really adored her, then you wouldn't be home from 4 o'clock till 12 o'clock every night without taking some time to show her that you adored her. So when we talk about the idea of being intimate, we talk about something very different from what Western culture describes. Western culture describes to us a situation where a man likes her beauty, and a man is always thinking how much he's going to enjoy being with the woman. It's all about himself. It's nothing about giving to her. And the Torah, when it speaks about intimacy, the Torah is talking about giving, not about taking. If you listen to all the love songs, you look at all the... Look, what are they doing when they're showing you all the pornography? You don't love the person. There's nothing about the other person. It's all about a person's fantasies of what he himself is going to enjoy. The Torah presents us with a totally different perspective on intimacy. It's about giving. It's about really loving. If you ask me, one of the greatest hardships that secular Jews have today is marriage. Because I think people don't know how to love someone else. Western society trains us very well to love ourselves. Western society is very focused on what are my rights. That's why everyone has lawyers, because we all have rights. But Western society does not train us how to love someone else. And all the love songs you're going to hear are saying nothing about it. They're all focused about me. So when we're about to talk about family purity, we have to get it in perspective. The way we view a home is that if you're sitting and talking to your wife, you know, I teach couples. So one of the things I tell the chatanim is, if you're sitting and talking to your wife like this over supper, then I think you're a bum. So the guy says, what did I do? I say, wait a second, talk to your wife. You should be sitting like this. I mean, you have an opportunity to show her affection and you forgo that opportunity? Anytime you have an opportunity to show affection to your wife, you take advantage of it. The fact that outside the house we're modest and you won't see a Jewish husband kissing his wife in the streets, that's because we value it. But behind the closed doors, behind the curtains, inside the house, then in every opportunity, a husband is encouraged, it's considered a biblical mitzvah, to show his wife whatever affection he can. That's his obligation. And sometimes, to a person from the outside, it seems like, all these laws of family purity, oh, you estrange your wives. Quite the contrary. Speak to a Jewish woman, go see many observant homes, and you'll see that they're very, very happy. They're not complaining. It's people who are on the outside and trying to interpret what's going on the inside and inventing all these myths about a blanket with a hole in it. They're the ones who are talking about problems in the Jewish home. How come our divorce rate is low? It's not because they're scared of divorce. It's because people are happy. Ask the average person who's in an Orthodox marriage, in an observant home. They're happy. So then we come to a mitzvah in the Torah, where the Torah says that from the minute a woman starts menstruating, she's called a nida, and then when the menstruation finishes, then she cleanses herself, and then for 7 days she checks herself to make sure that she's clean. And at the end of that period, which is usually about 13 days, the average woman menstruates for about 6 days, and then 7 days of cleanliness. After 13 days, she goes to mikvah, and then she's pure, and then the couple could be together again. During those 13 days, they don't touch, they don't sleep together. That's the mitzvah of nida. But when they have the rest of the month, then there's every form of affection that you could imagine, because it's about a real relationship. The mitzvah of nida is not an easy mitzvah. The average couple, when they first get married and they suddenly realize, wait a second, you want to tell me, every Jew in his house, no one knows what's happening between him and his wife, but people are really doing this? People sit back and they're in awe Every chassan goes through this period where he sits in awe of the Jewish people. He says, what an amazing people. Think about it. No one knows what's going on behind closed doors. No one knows what you and your wife do. No one's going to know if you keep this mitzvah or not. So kashrus, you could say, no, I want to keep kosher in my house. I keep kosher. Doesn't come anywhere near the hardship of keeping the laws of family purity. It's not easy. If two people have affections for one another, the last thing they want to do is separate their beds, not touch one another, etc. But Chazal tell us a very interesting thought. Our sages say the tendency of the human man is that he gets tired of his wife. The tendency of man is that he likes variety. And the tendency of man is that he wants to be promiscuous. He doesn't want to be faithful to one wife. Go look in the newspapers. Our sages say that when the Torah gave us this mitzvah, and the Torah said, you take 13 days where you don't touch her. You guys aren't intimate. In a certain sense, the Torah gave us a rejuvenation of our relationships. We're not saying that's why the Torah gave us this mitzvah. We don't know why. Meaning there could be many reasons why God knew this was the right thing for us. But one benefit that we see from it, and there have been many papers written on it in the last few decades, is that the bond in the Jewish home is much stronger. The fact that you have to spend part of the month where you don't have the intimacy on that level. So then you suddenly develop the relationship on a different level. You know, we have a mitzvah that a couple, when they're prohibited, when they're not allowed to touch one another, they're supposed to go to sleep, each one in their own beds, but together. Because they're still going to have special conversation between them. And now, the relationship is on a totally different level. Because suddenly it's a relationship that's without any touch. It's with longing. It's with desire. It's with affection. But it's very different. And I have to tell you, there are a lot of people who have told me that they're not on a level where they're observant, but this mitzvah is something they value. They're going to try to keep it theoretically. They don't last. It's very hard to keep this mitzvah. The only way a person can keep it is if he's really going to be a God-fearing person and say, this is what God wants me, this is what I'm going to do. Afterwards, he could reap the benefits. But if a person is going to try to do this from a theoretical point, I understand the benefits, I'm going to try, he's not going to stand out there because his desire is going to overtake him. Not an easy mitzvah, it's a hard mitzvah. It's a mitzvah that we benefit from. But I don't know of anyone who could stick to this type of regimen unless it's because he fears God. It's not easy. Okay, any questions on this? Okay.
What about the living room? In which case, he does have variety.
Okay, but you know, it's been a millennium now where rabbinically polygamy is prohibited, so you know, it's not so relevant.
The idea is still there.
You're saying in so it's not so clear that the Torah, that this leads us to another concept, that not everything that's permitted in the Torah is recommended in the Torah. Meaning there are areas where the Torah says you could do what you want, but I don't necessarily recommend it. And polygamy seems to be one of those areas. Where the Torah doesn't prohibit it, but the Torah also doesn't seem to be so pro.
I don't understand the point of committing something yet, like looking down on it.
So that's a long conversation. It's a good question.
It's like a parent sort of like taking a child on a guilt trip, do what you want, but I wouldn't do that, kind of.
But sometimes it's the right move. If you think about it, sometimes you can't tell a kid, no, you're not allowed to do this. Sometimes you could tell a kid, you know, I don't think you'll gain from this. You could come to a kid and you see your kid, he's staying up late watching a movie, and you tell him, look, I think you're going to have a really hard time studying tomorrow. If you're going to try to come down on the kid and tell him, you're going to sleep now, he's going to say, no, it's just at the point of suspense, I just another 5 minutes, you're not going to win. And at the end of the day, you have to say what you have to say, and sometimes it's not even something which you can say, you're doing something terrible. It's not terrible, it's just not beneficial. You're going to lose from it. A kid has a class trip tomorrow, right? You tell him, if you go to sleep early, you're going to enjoy much more. Should you really bawl him out and tell him, you go to sleep, and you're... No, you shouldn't, if you do your bad there. On the other hand, you should try to encourage him positively so that he enjoys the trip tomorrow. If he'll be wiped out, he's going to enjoy much less. He might vomit on the bus ride, you know. But can you really come to him and tell him with all force, this, you're not allowed to stay up, you're going to go to sleep? You're a bad parent. You're misusing your force. There are areas which are areas that are not, it's not prohibited, it's just not recommended. And just like, and as a parent, you'll also see that. we have a mitzvah, pidyon ben. If a person has a firstborn son, Torah says in Egypt, the firstborns were in danger of death. And God said, I'll only kill the Egyptians and I'll let the Jewish firstborn live. And ever since then, God says, every time you have a firstborn, remember that your firstborns could have died in Egypt, and I saved them, and so redeem your firstborn. So to speak, we redeem him from death. When the child is 30 days old, we go to a coin, and we give him the value of 5 silver coins, which is about, today, it's... what's how much is that today? That's about, I could tell you in American dollars, that's about 50 American dollars. That's the value today. We have silver coins that we use. We have an exact weight that the Torah tells us. I don't remember the exact weight. It's 5 silver coins, but I don't remember how much that comes out in grams of silver, and depends on the price of silver at that time. So we estimate, and we take something that's worth more than that. Usually we take a bunch of coins just to commemorate the idea of the coins, and we take coins that have more than that amount of silver within them.
The fact that you give the money to a Kohen to redeem your firstborn, would that be different if the Chet HaEgel had not occurred and the Bechorim would be the ones performing the Avodah in Mishkan?
It seems that way, but that's not so clear. I don't know
so
the answer to that.
So would that mean that also the Bechorim would not be redeemed?
I don't know.
Because if the reason is because of Mitzrayim,
right,
maybe they would be redeemed anyway.
Right. But it could be they wouldn't need to be redeemed if they were Kohanim. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's a question I have for many years, and I don't know the answer. Okay, when we speak about Shabbos, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Can't be left.
What do you say?
It's a rest day.
Steve, what else?
Challah.
What else?
Family time.
Okay. So, what does it say in the Ten Commandments?
Shemor
b'zachor. Oh. What does that mean, Steve? Help us out. What does it mean, zachor?
It was to remember.
What does it mean to remember?
Well, to remember that it's a day of rest.
Oh, so the idea of remembering is a few things. The idea is that all week long you remember it.
Yeah.
Meaning, if you get a good soft drink, you get a good coffee, you get a good chocolate bar on Tuesday, you could eat it on Tuesday, but you could also remember, hey, Shabbos is coming, I'll save it, and I'll honor Shabbos with that. We live in a day and age where it's hard to cherish anything, because you just figure, I'll just go to the store and I'll get another one tomorrow, right? But we all know, we don't always get another one, and we don't always have those delicious things for Shabbos. And so the mitzvah of remembering Shabbos throughout the week is to remember it so that I enjoy it. So I save my delicious things for Shabbos, provided that they'll last, right? They serve you a good steak here for lunch. You try saving it for Shabbos, it's not going to be so good, right? That's not the point. But there are things that will be good for Shabbos. So that's one way of remembering Shabbos. Another way is that we remember it when it enters and when it leaves. We make kiddush. That's a biblical mitzvah. When Shabbos sets in, Friday night, we make kiddush over a cup of wine. What are we saying in kiddush? We're saying, God, we hereby designate, we hereby sanctify the Shabbos that has settled in upon us. That's the biblical mitzvah of the Ten Commandments, the Zachor Yom HaShabbat, to remember the day of Shabbos to sanctify. And we also delineate when Shabbos ends, when we do Havdalah. Those are the two ends, right? The two endpoints, the beginning and the end of Shabbos. So that's Zachor. We have a mitzvah to honor Shabbos. What can you think that we do in honor of Shabbos?
Challah.
Okay, challah is the joy of Shabbos. We have two concepts. Onik Shabbos, the enjoyment of Shabbos, and Kavod Shabbos, the honor of Shabbos. But maybe challah is also honorable, right? It's nicer bread than the regular bread.
No, but it's the honor with the manna.
So okay.
So Shabbat we had two lots of manna instead of one.
Yefeh, very nice, right? What else? What do we light for Shabbos?
Candles.
Ah. So that's we have a nicer meal. Remember, you have to light candles before the sun sets, right? Now, I light candles on Shabbos. What else do we do? What clothing? Yeah.
Nicer clothing,
right? What do you think we do to enjoy Shabbos?
Good food.
We have good food.
Smirot.
What else?
We relax,
right? You know, it says in Halacha you're supposed to daven later on Shabbos. Shulis, but you're supposed to have a later minion on Shabbos for us.
No, that's not true in
Israel.
I don't know. Here in Israel, I also have a hard time with that, right? Us from Chutzlitz, we're used to good old 9:30 minionim, right? But hey, that's what it's. I got my share. Say those, I'm going to catch my bye bye. So,
I don't know what he said. So if you already have gone down.
Says you have to get up to say Shema and done.
I'm at 8 o'clock.
So we have a mitzvah of enjoying Shabbos. You know, part of the mitzvah of enjoying Shabbos is a person has a mitzvah, provided his wife is pure, that he and his wife should be intimate Friday night. Special mitzvah. It's part of what a person's supposed to have on Shabbos. Okay, so that's the mitzvah of Shabbos. We have mitzvah of challah. What's the mitzvah of challah?
Separate a bit of the dough.
Right. When you make a certain volume of dough, so we used to give it the kohen today that we don't have pure kohanim, we burn it, we make a blessing before we separate it. The custom used to be that in honor of Shabbos, women used to bake their own bread. All week long, they'd buy non-Jewish bread from the baker. On Shabbos, they'd bake their own bread in order to perform this mitzvah of taking off the challah. And that's where it came from, that we call the bread of Shabbos challah. Really, it's not challah. Challah is what you give to the kohen, what we burn. But because the custom was...
A certain quantity you have to do challah.
Correct.
Not only Shabbat.
Correct. Any time you prepare dough of a certain quantity, you have to have a certain volume.
What's that?
I don't remember. Look it up. Want me to look it up? Tell you in one second. Okay. Shatnez. You guys know what the mitzvah of Shatnez is?
No.
Torah says you shouldn't wear wool and linen together in one garment. So... The Gemara asks, where does Shatnez come from? The Gemara says maybe Shatnez is a combination of a few words. Shua, Tavui, Venuz. Those are three stages in making the string. You spin it, you weave it, you tie it together. So Shatnez is that, it's a biblical prohibition. You should know that if you're going to buy expensive suits, $800 Hugo Boss suits, so there it's more frequent that the lapel will be made of linen. And there are laboratories here in Israel. Oh, very nice. The check for Shatnez. Very nice. Where is this?
It's my uncle, my family in Israel. He's
very nice.
Just around the corner.
Very nice. I didn't know there was a Shatnez laboratory here.
To check for Shatnez, do you have to cut the material open, or do you just look at the tag and see what it says?
No, you have to. You have to look right into it.
So they take out strings. They could take out strings, and the way they used to do it is they'd burn them or they put chemicals on them and then see how they react to the chemicals to see what material they are. Today, they look at them under a microscope, and they know under a microscope how to tell what's wool and what's linen. The problem is that the tags are very inaccurate, and I don't know of any country in the world that really enforces the law on this. You know, you could go to a store here and they'll tell you pure cashmere for 25 shekel. It's not pure cashmere for 25 shekel, guaranteed.
Once it's 100% wool, but there's patches that are made of linen, which they don't inform you about.
Sure, yeah, yeah. You can buy a suit that says 100% wool and it's 30% polyester.
Yeah.
There are so many games, and it's not. I don't know why. No government bothers enforcing this. There are a lot of games. Yes, I'm telling you, in the U.S. and in Israel, I had stories where people took clothing to a Shatnez laboratory, and the guy said, I know the tag says it's 100% this or 100% that, but it's nowhere near that. And they don't tell you what they make the lapel out of, and they don't tell you what they're sewing the buttons with. There are many other strings in the garment. Again, it's more common in more expensive clothing. Cheaper clothing have Shatnez less frequently. Torah says we're not allowed to crossbreed animals. Torah says you're not allowed to crossbreed plants.
You're not allowed to let two different species work in the same field.
Well, you're not allowed to bind them together in their work. Meaning, technically, he could be working here and she could be working there, and that's fine. The idea is if they're bound together, if they're working.
Two animals bound in one yoke, how are they going to
procreate? It's a separate prohibition. It's irrespective of procreation. You're not allowed to put them in one yoke. The issue isn't that it's a separate prohibition. You're right. There's a prohibition of procreating two animals. And in that, the Torah says you could put them in one corral. Meaning you could put a donkey and a horse in one corral, and if they happen to mate, you don't have to stop them. The Torah doesn't say you have to be so careful they shouldn't procreate. The Torah says you're not allowed to put one on top of the other and make them procreate. But if they procreate, that's their business, and you could enjoy the byproduct. You could even put them in one corral in the hope that they'll procreate. That's okay. But you can't put them in one yoke. That's a separate prohibition. Different prohibition. Okay, we have the prohibition of meat and milk. So we're not allowed to eat meat with milk together. We're not allowed to cook meat with milk together. And if meat and milk were cooked together, so we're not allowed to derive benefit from that. Any questions on this?
Isn't it that 1/60th rule?
If a drop of milk fell into a pot of meat, that's b'di'evet. If it happened, but you're not allowed to do it like a chiva.
Yeah.
We
is the original, like, without the takanat rabbanan, is the prohibition only to cook them?
No, also to eat them also and also to dry bind it. The Torah says it three times. One time it says to tell me the prohibition on cooking. One time the prohibition of eating. And one time.
The first time.
Could be in Mishpatim, yeah. Could be, I don't remember.
It's the one before the Vayakha.
Kitisa?
Yeah.
Okay. Could be, I don't remember.
So this, that law comes under you can't cook a calf in its mother's milk.
Right.
And what about chickens and eggs?
What about them?
Chickens
No, but I'm saying couldn't you then say you can't have egg and chicken together?
Oh, so it's a good question, right? We might say that. The rabbis in the Talmud work out how traditionally we derive that it's only specifically meat with milk. You're right. How do I know that I can't, you know, how can I make schnitzel? You know, I'm coating the chicken with its egg. Right. So the Talmud goes through how we derive what's permitted and what's prohibited. Good question, right? The Torah gives us... You guys have any other questions on this?
No.
The Torah gives us a mitzvah to honor the elder. And you'll notice on Israeli buses, there are even stickers that say, Hadatap and Ezaken, honor the elder. An old man walks in, you're supposed to stand up and give him your seat. It's not only give him your seat, it's also stand up out of honor. If a guy who's 70 years old walks in, they were supposed to stand up. and this applies to someone who's learned in Torah, even if he's not old. It applies to someone who's old, even if he's not Jewish. Even if he's not Jewish, the guy has made it to old age, we give certain respect. The Medrash brings an interesting story that once one of the Roman kings saw an old Jew and he honored him. So his servants asked him, why are you honoring him? He's a Jew. So he said, look, if his master valued him and left him on this planet for so many years, don't you think I should value him? A person who made it to old age, obviously, in God's eyes, is worth being around. Hopefully, you know. I'm not sure every old person is worth being around. I could think of a few that I can't understand why they're worth being around, but that's not a nice thing to say, right? Okay.
Before you continue.
I was thinking of especially evil people, you guys. I wasn't thinking about, like, my next-door neighbor, right? Yeah.
With meat and milk, I know that Sfardim, or at least some Sfardim, don't eat fish and milk.
Right.
Why is that?
The Talmud says that that fish and meat can be harmful to a person. That's why we don't eat fish and meat together. We use separate dishes. Talmud says that can cause a person some kind of skin disease, like tzaras. Some don't have that custom anymore, because... we don't see, for centuries now, we haven't seen anyone who eats fish with meat have any problems. In the days of the Talmud, they must have had some problems, but it's been over a millennium where nothing's been recorded on it. So we still have the custom to be careful with fish and meat. Sephardim have a custom to apply this care also on fish and milk. It's a Sephardi custom. And the Talmud doesn't say that. It's a Sephardi custom to distance yourself also from fish and milk, that eating the two together can also be, it's a health hazard. It's not a halachic issue. Meaning the halacha tells us to be careful from health hazards. Just like the halacha says, you're not allowed to suck on a coin. Because who knows what germs are on that coin. So they didn't know the word germs. They said there are diseases on the coins. You don't put a coin in your mouth. So the halacha warns us from things that are unhealthy. But it's not really halachic, it's more medical.
So once, if a Sephardi woman marries an Ashkenazi man, she develops immunities towards
fish. It's a good question, right? How does that work? We have a mitzvah to bring in guests into our home, provided that they don't harm us, within a certain... reason. We have mitzvah of achnasat ochim, like Avraham Avinu did. We have tzedakah to give charity. You gotta go? We have 5 minutes. Okay, we'll wait. Go ahead.
We've got you in 5 minutes. Okay. Where are you? Okay. Where are we?
Yeah.
Just where are we?
And me.
Okay. We're mitzvah to give charity. So we're mitzvah to give tzedakah. Ideally, a person should try to give a tithe, 1/10 of his income. When you guys are starting out, if your income is low, consult with the rabbi, because sometimes we say, when a person's income is low, so we say do it after taxes, so to speak, after your expenses. Meaning, if a guy's only making a small amount and he's barely paying rent and barely paying his basic expenses, so then we say, okay, so give your 10th after taxes, after you've paid all your expenses, because otherwise you're not going to last. Afterwards, when you're better off and you don't have to rely on that leniency, then you'll give your 10th before all your expenses. But a person should try to do that. Those people who take off a tithe, those people who partition their money, they get their paycheck, 10% goes to the side for use for good deeds, end up doing a lot of good deeds in their lives. Those people who say, oh, it'll come, I'll fund it, when I will be able to, I'll do it, they don't end up doing a lot in their lives. It's an excellent habit to get into. When the money's on the side, you'll end up doing a lot of good with it. So the habit has to be a separate bank account, a separate place where you put that money, and then you'll end up doing good things. You'll see. You'll have opportunities and you'll have the money for them.
I heard once one of my rabbis told me that the money you're supposed to have, you're going to have. So if you give tzedakah, then you're going to end up, so that money will go there instead of you losing it some other way because of hashgacha pratit or whatever. So can you depend on that?
And to an extent, within the framework of halacha.
Even if you're making like a small amount of money to begin with, still give a tenth and depend and sort of rely on Hashem, so to speak.
I don't know that I would do that.
That you need.
I don't know that I would do that. I don't know that I would do that. The halacha does tell us, and why should Hashem help you if you're not doing it in the confines of halacha? You know, the halacha tells us there's a way to do it. So that's why I said consult with the rabbi. I didn't say you decide which leniency to apply when. I'm just saying there are areas where we would be more lenient. We, in line with the concept that Doron just mentioned, we have a concept in Judaism of atbash. You guys familiar with that?
No.
That letters are interchangeable. The
yeah.
first letter with the last letter of the alphabet. Second letter with the second
yeah.
to last. Third letter with the third to last. Fourth with the fourth to last. Fifth with the fifth to last. So let's take the word tzedakah. Tzadi is the fifth to last letter. What's the fifth letter?
Hey.
Dalit is the fourth to last letter. What's the fourth? Is the fourth letter.
Kuf.
What's the fourth to last? Kuf. Kuf is
Dalid.
And Hey is Tzadi. So they say, Tzedakah, when you give out, it comes back in. Tzedakah and Atbash is backwards Tzedakah, right? That's the idea you just said. Whatever you're supposed to have, you're going to have. Whatever you're giving to the poor, God will ensure you get that. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You got 2 minutes. We have mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim. Someone's in captivity, we have a special mitzvah to redeem them. And that supersedes everything else. Chazal say, there are different types of suffering in this world, and being in captivity encompasses all of them. It's every type of torture you could imagine.
Yeah, we've learned that. We did that with Rabbi Shah.
And that's why, ordinarily, we would never sell a Sefer Torah. But if a guy's in captivity, we sell a Sefer Torah to take him out of captivity. Because we say, that's so important, to take this guy out of his suffering. You guys know there's a man named Jonathan Pollard. You guys heard of him? He's in American prison for 17 or 19 years now. Thanks to him, we have gas masks. America had a treaty with Israel that they were supposed to share information with us. And America had information that Saddam Hussein was preparing chemical warfare against us, and they were not giving us that information. Jonathan Pollard, a Jew in the American intelligence, kept asking his superiors, why aren't we giving this information over to Israel? When he saw they weren't giving the information, he himself went to the embassy and gave over the information to Israel. Thanks to him, all of Israel has gas masks today. It's him. The American government found out about it. They took him to court. When they took him to court, they told him, don't argue in court, and we'll, behind the scenes afterwards, we'll free you. And he signed the deal, being told that afterwards they'll set him free quietly. He signed the deal that he's not allowed to plea bargain and that he's in jail for life. And then they said, we never said it. We don't know what you're talking about. And now he's sitting in jail for life. Jonathan Pollard, you'll see signs about him all over. Pidyon Shvuyim, one of the big mitzvot.
Wait, just 1 second. I'm sorry.
So where you can, if you have tzedakah money, you should know that's a great place to direct your money or your time. You know, writing letters to senators, writing letters and trying to move things. You never know what'll work. We have to try. I daven every day. His name is Yonasan ben Malka, Jonathan Pollard. Yonasan ben Malka. We have to do whatever we can to get him out. It's a huge mitzvah. Okay, we're out of time. We have two more mitzvot I want to cover. One's the mitzvah of chinuch. We have a biblical mitzvah to educate our kids to Torah and mitzvot. It's a biblical mitzvah. It's your responsibility, B'ezrat Hashem, when you have kids. And the last mitzvah, we'll get to B'ezrat Hashem a different time, is the concept of tzniut. It's a concept of hygiene. It's a concept of good traits. We have a biblical mitzvah to emulate God. And emulating God means adopting all the positive traits that we can imagine, that God is described as having all those positive traits, being merciful, being kind. And it also includes cleanliness and also includes all the good traits that we can imagine God is described as having. And that's a way of teaching us that we're supposed to emulate Him in those traits. And B'ezrat Hashem a different time, we'll expand on it. Yisher koach. I really enjoyed it.